Hi everyone, welcome to the Deep Psychology Podcast. I'm your host, Ross Edwards, four-time author, humanistic existential coach, and host of the Deep Psychology Podcast. Today, we are talking about pre-conventional ego development, continuing on with our in-depth September series on Kuk-Reuter's ego development theory. So this really is a continuation of last week's episode, and it's a crucial piece of the entire ego development puzzle. When we say pre-conventional ego development, we basically mean the lower tail of the developmental bell curve. Most people aren't at pre-conventional levels. Most adults aren't, because they grow beyond it. It's normal for young children to be here, and although they usually grow beyond it. And if you find adults at pre-conventional levels, often they cannot fully look after themselves and are not fully integrated into ordinary society. These stages are stages of low ego complexity, autonomy, freedom, flexibility, self-awareness, and skill in interacting with the environment. It represents pre-adult, pre-civilized, pre-ego, pre-socialized stages. And you likely moved through all these stages way before possibly primary school, certainly before high school. Most people move through them, and by the time you're done, you'll be into conventional levels of development. So today we're going to really dig deep into these pre-conventional levels. Just want to say before I get going that I have new long-form episodes like this every Wednesday, with snippets on Thursday, Sunday and Tuesday, always at 9 p.m. Central European Time, 8 p.m. UK Time and 3 p.m. Eastern Time. Make sure to subscribe on Apple or Spotify. And if you want to go deeper with this work, you can join my fortnightly newsletter, pre-order my latest book, The Boundless Body, or try a free coaching session with me. Links are in the description for all of those. And I would really encourage you to listen to the entire ego development series from this month, which I'll also link to in the description. If you want to get a really complete overview of ego development theory, which comes from Susan Kuk-Reuter, this is what you really want to listen to. And I would also encourage, as I did last week, you go and read Susan Kuk-Reuter's 9 levels paper to accompany these audios. If you just search Susan Kuk-Reuter 9 levels, you will probably find her paper on this subject on the internet. Before we get going, just want to mention my sponsor, Spirit Quest Tours, which takes small groups on exclusive sacred journeys to Egypt, Peru, and Turkey. Get $500 off your next trip by using the discount code ROSS on the booking page linked below. All right, let's get going with pre-conventional ego development. So one thing you might be wondering is, Ross, why are we learning about pre-conventional ego development if most adults aren't here? We usually go through them by the time we're in primary school, and they seem really quite far removed from ordinary adult life and functioning. Yes, indeed, you might have these doubts. However, if you're having these doubts, just listen to what I'm going to say, because you might be surprised. First of all, these stages describe how you were as an infant. We all go through these stages. We all start at ground zero, and we develop through them. Even if we get very late levels of ego development, we start out here. So that's fascinating, because you literally went through these stages. And if you look back to the very early years of your life, well, you can see the dominance of these stages, and you can realize just how different you are now that you've gone through them all. They also help you understand what conventional development is built on, because if you understand pre-conventional development, it gives you a contrast. You can understand better what conventional development actually means. It's really easy to take conventional development for granted when actually, you know, it's something we have to develop. You know, conventional development often just seems like ordinary adulthood. And even I will describe it like that, because that's effectively what it is. But when you think of it like that, you can take it for granted, when actually there's a lot that needs to happen for a person to reach conventional adulthood. You'll also grasp clearly the difference between pre- and post-conventional development. This is a really big point right here. If you're post-conventional, and you'll know exactly what that means by the end of this month, you might confuse post-conventional for pre-conventional, because in some respects, especially the highest stages of post-conventional development, they might seem like the very early stages of pre-conventional development. But what you'll realize is that actually they're very, very different, like so unbelievably different. It's just that when you've not really studied these things, you might not quite appreciate the great differences that there are between them. Like, you often hear like meditation masters talking about babies in a kind of reverential way, as though babies were enlightened. Now, I'm not saying they necessarily think babies are enlightened, right? Because I think they probably realize that being enlightened and being a baby are quite different. But still, it's like they don't quite realize exactly what being a baby means. And there's very good evidence for what being a baby means, right? And that's what we're going to cover. And so you're going to understand the difference between being highly developed and having very low development, which is a distinction that a lot of people struggle to make, which is quite surprising, but it genuinely happens. Also help you understand the children and infants you deal with, because children and all stages of development are inhabiting different worlds, right? But when you're dealing with children and infants especially, it can seem like they're in a really, really different world. So studying these things theoretically will help you grasp what their life is like from their point of view. Okay, and that will help you. It doesn't necessarily mean it will be smooth sailing, but you'll maybe understand better how to deal with children and infants. And also because these levels are still active in you. They're still available to you. They're still part of your repertoire. This is something I really emphasized last week, that levels are like the stages of ego development. They're like an expanding spiral. So they build on top of one another. Or they're like Russian dolls. You know, the biggest Russian doll contains the next biggest, which contains the next biggest, which ultimately contains the smallest. And that's really the same as you. You know, even if you're far, far beyond pre-conventional ego development, it's still there. It's like you can still operate from it, and you still do operate from it, right? These are like the base levels of your psyche. This is like the, you know, if you're constructing a house of cards, or a building, like these are the foundations of your entire mind. So it might be useful to know what the foundations of your mind actually are. And a lot of it's not pretty, unfortunately. And listen, in moments of stress or periods of stress, you know, whether it's an argument or whether it's something more lasting, like you lose your job and you have to go through unemployment, for example. In these times, I'm not going to say you necessarily go down to a specific level, but I'm just going to say in general, you go down to sort of pre-conventional type levels. You know, you really, your psyche changes and you become a lot more, you feel more threatened, and your actions and your behavior often match that, okay? So I want you to notice in these times that these more primal, basic levels appear. And I want you to make the connection between what I'm talking about here, like the exact details that we're going to cover, and what you are like in those moments, okay? So that's really the biggest reason for me, is that these are levels of functioning that you still have. It's not, you're not necessarily there all the time. Like, most of the time you won't be. If you're listening to this, listen, I'm assuming you're probably not a pre-conventional adult, but, you know, they're certainly still there, and you still use them, and you should still use them in certain circumstances. So what actually is pre-conventional ego development from like a bigger point of view? Before we talk about the stages, I think we need to really understand what's the big picture here. So what's basically happening is, when we're born, we start at ground zero in ego development. We don't have an ego, we don't have any self-referencing, which, in other words, we don't refer anything back to ourselves at all. Like, you know, you look at your mum and you don't refer your mum back to yourself. You just see your mum. You don't have any interpretations. You're not interpreting the world in any level. And you don't have any meaning-making capacity. You don't take your experience and construct meaning around it, which is really what ego development is all about, is how we do that in ever more complicated ways. So we're going from that. We're basically going from having no mind, I suppose you could say, to conventional ego development. You know, once we go through pre-conventional, we get to conventional, which in broad terms means that there's a genuine subject-object split. In other words, we recognize that our body and our mind are our own, and the rest of the world around us is not us. The world, like the desk is not us, the coffee machine is not us, the wall is not us, other people are not us. That's the subject-object split. The way we interpret reality at conventional levels is in line with the demands and expectations of society. We have conventional meaning-making, in other words, like, the way we think about what life actually means is a convention. You know, it's sort of acceptable to the majority. Okay. So you can think, you know, that is pre-conventional is going from zero ego to having all of that. So this is like going through pre-conventional successfully actually gets you to being like a functional, civilized adult. Right, so this is no big deal, I was about to say. This is a big deal. Like, this is, for most people, this is all the development they go through in life. Most of the development they go through is just this. So that's kind of the big picture of it. We go from zero ego to conventional ego. Pre-conventional ego development describes the normal stages of child development up until children become socialized, they learn the rules, they have impulse control, they can cooperate, they can fulfill responsibilities to a certain degree, they have a functional moral sense, and so on and so forth. So they're sort of like, they might still be young, but they're essentially like civilized, and they understand that they need to cooperate, and you know, they can live an ordinary life without having to be fully dependent on adults, right? So, again, that's a big deal. If we're looking at from the children, the point of view of child development, it's a huge deal for children to go through pre-conventional. Like, it's the first 10 to 15 years of a child's life. However, there is no guarantee that a child will complete pre-conventional development. And in fact, there's a significant chunk of adults that do not complete pre-conventional development at all, ever. And these people often require care and guardianship, or they're not very well like socialized. They find it hard to function properly. At pre-conventional, we are yet, like, this is true of all the three pre-conventional stages we're going to cover, are yet to develop a true second person perspective, which basically means that we cannot see another person as a person with their own life, their own needs, their own life story, their own life, you know, their own challenges, their own desires and so forth. We cannot see another person with any great complexity or detail, right? So that is how basic these levels are. if you can do that, then I'm asking you to kind of imagine that you can't do that. And that is what pre-conventional is. You literally are not capable of taking the perspective of another person in a genuine way, free of your own biases and your own needs, okay? The pre-conventional levels are the beginning of the construction of the separate self, your own self-identity, and this peaks at the achiever level. So, which the achiever level, by the way, is a conventional level. So, you can think of the pre-conventional as like the first ascent of our, like the building of our mind and our identity as a human. Like from nothing, from no identity, from no mind, from no ego, we're built, this is like the first phase of that. Excuse me, the first phase of that. Now, just take that in for a moment. Like, you are born with zero identity, zero sense of self and other. You look around, you can't tell the difference between your body and the room. You can't speak. You don't understand what time is. You don't understand what the external world is in any functional way. You have no capacity. You can't even walk. You can't move when we're, well, you can move, but very hardly. You're dependent on everyone around you. From that, we get someone who is like a civilized adult who can look after themselves enough to kind of function in society. That is staggering. And it's something we often don't think about very much. We only often think about it when we're around babies who can't do the most basic things. But I want you to realize that you went through this. And also, it's not just a physical thing, and it's not just about skills. It's actually your entire psyche grows along with all the skills and all the capacities you develop. You know, to walk, to talk, to relate to people, and so on and so forth. Another crucial insight, the final crucial insight before we cover the stages, is that in general, you know, yeah, pretty much we can say that at pre-conventional, we have very little choice over our behavior. Like, self-awareness is very low, reflection is very low, our ability to kind of look at our behavior objectively, our ability to take in feedback from other people is just extremely limited. So that is like, wow, that is, it's quite mind-blowing just to like realize that this is like a genuine limitation. You cannot choose how you behave, really. The ability to really choose how to behave only comes on to any real degree at conventional, and then it increases through post-conventional. It's really just a dimension or a variable that increases as with ego development, okay? But whenever we're talking about these stages, realize that like there is, this is very, all these things are very, these are, these stages are very automatic. Like, they're very driven by impulse, they're driven by needs and desires. They're not really thinking very far ahead. And as I said, they cannot reflect on themselves to any real level. So the stages of pre-conventional development, there's three of them, and they are called, well, there's three of them in Cook-Reuter's model. They're called symbiotic, impulsive, and opportunistic. You're going to understand why they're called these once we've done describing them. And symbiotic is number one, impulsive is number two, and opportunistic is 2/3. So notice that the first two are whole numbered stages, and then there's a slash stage. We'll talk about why that is when we get to opportunistic. But this is not, like, the rest of this Kuggreuter model, the stages don't appear like that. They appear whole number slash. It's just for these three, if you're really interested in the geeky theory, it goes whole slash, and then we're back to like alternate. So let's get going with talking about these stages in detail. Just before we do that, quick mention of my sponsor, Spirit Quest Tours, which takes small groups on exclusive sacred journeys to Egypt, Peru, and Turkey. Get $500 off your next trip by using the discount code ROSS on the booking page linked below. Cool, let's talk about stage one, which is symbiotic. It's called symbiotic. So we're born, when we're born as humans, basically what researchers think happens, and there's plenty of evidence for this, is that we're born undifferentiated, which basically means that we have our senses, we have our sense of sight, our sense of sound, our sense of touch. You know, these things develop, but we have them to a certain degree. But these things, all of the phenomena generated by those, in other words, the entire world we experience, we do not experience it to be separated out in any way. And this includes the people that are around us, like our caregivers, like our mum or dad, possibly our siblings at that age. We are fused with them. Like, we literally do not perceive any difference between us and them. You look at your mother as a very young baby, and there's no sense that that is your mother, and the thing that is looking at your mother is you. Like, there is no, that just does not exist. It's something that has to develop over time. So, no surprise then, and this is something we spoke about last week, the importance of perspective taking. The perspective taking at this level is basically there is no perspective taking. We call it the zeroth person perspective because there's no self, there's no other, there's a complete fusion with the senses, the environment around you, other people. So you cannot take a perspective on anything because to take a perspective, there needs to be a sense of self and a sense of other at minimum. Like that needs to happen. So it's a zeroth person perspective. This is reflected in the language used by infants at this stage. There's only very basic references to self, to world, to objects. Often it's pointing. Often it's like they look at things, but they can't label them. Again, no perspective taking is happening. Susan Kuggreuter says that the actions available at this stage are called nominal actions, which sounds very theoretical to me. What I'm assuming is that it's basically just what's available is basic, uncoordinated behaviour. Like, there's little control over the body, there's little control of motor skills and so on and so forth at this stage, which kind of adds to the oceanic feel of it, right? In terms of meaning making, you know, this whole model is about meaning making. Here we are basically learning to identify as a self. Like we basically do not have a sense of self at this stage. So you can basically forget meaning making because meaning making is always relative to the self. Like with meaning making, as I spoke last week, what we do is we take all the information from the world around us that's coming in, and according to our level of ego development, we package it and we construct meaning around it in such a way that makes sense to the self at that level. But here there is no self, right? So there's really no meaning making going on. It's normal for infants up to, you know, 6 months, a year, 18 months. In adults, this stage is very, very rare. Adults at this stage are usually institutionalized or they're completely dependent on caregivers because they cannot really use language at all. They're fused with the environment. They can't see other people as having as people with their own lives and their own desires and their own view on things, and there's no real sense of time. So this is like completely prior to ordinary independent adult functioning, okay? In terms of usual child development, it covers development that occurs between birth and the beginning capacity for language. To see it in adults, you're not going to see it often, but think of like non-verbal adults. Like maybe it's someone with like a severe disability or a severe like mental dysfunction, or an old person who is, in a bad state. It's not pretty at all, but it's important that we cover this because we take our development completely for granted. We take all of the things that this stage lacks, we take it for granted. And what I want you to realize is that this stage is almost like base human awareness. This is like the base experience of being human. Like, without idealizing it, without saying that these people are enlightened or anything, but just saying, like, this is, like, ground zero of being human. Like, this is the most basic, okay? And on top of this, everything else is built. So, to sum it up, it's normal for infants to be here, normal for them to have no sense of self whatsoever, to not be able to use language, to not have a worldview, to not have a meaning-making capacity, and so on and so forth. Adults here really cannot function at all. Now, let's move on. Stage two is called the impulsive stage, okay? This is a really big move in particularly in child development. This is when the first person perspective appears for the first time. As I said, stage one, the symbiotic stage, where we're just symbiotically merged or fused with everything around us. It doesn't have a sense of self at all. It's a zeroth person perspective. Stage two is a first person perspective because there's now a sense of self. The self is now differentiated enough from the environment such that the person can now say I, they can say me, they can say mine, they can refer to themselves physically, like their body, their most basic impulses. So it's not like a complex, nuanced sense of self, but the person probably looks at the table that they're sitting at and realizes it to enough of an extent that the table is not them and that their body is them, right? They might also look at other people and realize that the other person is looking at them, okay? they're not just, you know, the other person is not them, and the other person is also looking at them. So there's like a bit, there's a bit of sense of self in other here. And they also might look at, you know, just any object around them and realize that, okay, that isn't really me. Whereas before, stage one, the infant or the adult didn't realize that. So it's a rudimentary sense of self in other. You wouldn't call this an adult sense of self and other, but, you know, it's something. What I find interesting is that the self-other and having a sense of identity is actually necessary for language. Like, when you don't have a sense of self, at least at pre-conventional ego development, at post-conventional, this changes a bit, but at pre-conventional, it's necessary. Like, self and other and the function, the capacity for language develop together. Because listen, you can't understand what you means or what I means if you don't have a sense of self and other. Because someone could tell you, like, that is you and I'm me. But if you don't perceive any separation between you and them, that won't make any sense to you at all. Because it won't feel like they're actually making a distinction. Again, these things are really hard to like grasp if you're not at pre-conventional, but the basic point I'm trying to make is like, just realize that things like language and things like self and other and things like how we use our body and how we see the world around us, these things are all intertwined, okay? They facilitate each other, right? So that's why we're talking about these different aspects, because I really want to understand like the architecture of these stages. This person can now realize when they need something. Whereas before, at stage one, like, babies obviously have needs, but they cannot name their needs. And they, as far as we know, there is no real sense of ownership of the need. You know, they might feel that they're hungry, for example, but there's no, like, there's no sense, they can't label it hunger. They don't really know what the sense of hunger is. They feel the hunger, and there is a reaction, like the baby might start crying, and then when, you know, the mother starts feeding it, well, it will feed, but this, as far as we know, is all very automatic, whereas at stage two, it's more conscious. You know, it's, we couldn't really call this a very self-aware stage, but, you know, they recognize when they need something. The only thing is they don't have much of a sense of time yet, so they need it, they need, their needs to be met now, right? They need it now. So it's, this stage is about immediate gratification, hence the word impulsive. They also don't actually have much of an idea of how to get what they want. Because again, the worldview is very simple. The mind is very, very simple. And there's also just very little impulse control. So it just acts out its needs. So it's aware, and it can kind of name what it wants, and it can say, I, me, mine, and it can say no and yes. So, it, you know, it's expressing needs to some degree, but it's very rudimentary still. So there's a first-person perspective, but, you know, and there's, like, physical differentiation. In other words, the body is differentiated, but they cannot really look at people and understand that they are own people. They are their own people with their own needs still. The other people are just seen as means to one's own needs. So if they meet my needs, they are good. If they don't meet my needs, they are bad. Magical ideas prevail, and there's a sense of unlimited power because the perspective is egocentric. So the world and self are still pretty fused. You know, as I said, things like the body might be differentiated enough to say I, me, and mine, and to understand what that means. But, like, in terms of action, in terms of logic, in terms of time, in terms of desire, these things aren't really differentiated out yet, okay? So it's still very egocentric. And magical thinking prevails, meaning that basically with magical thinking, things, you think of things as though they were, like, merged together. So in magical thinking, you might imagine like a piece of broccoli or let's say a piece of chocolate, because that's something you might actually want. You imagine a piece of chocolate and you sort of confuse that with having it. You sort of mistake thinking about something and wanting something and sensing something as actually having something, which seems strange, but this is why I'm saying these levels are very basic. Adults at this stage are highly governed by their impulses and their needs. If these are not met, the adult has little means to cope beyond crying, screaming, or withdrawing. They are easily overwhelmed, and they can easily feel abandoned. And so, unsurprisingly, they really cannot navigate adult life very well. They need care and they need guardianship. So, you know, just to give you an example, if you're an adult at this stage and, you know, all of a sudden you feel hungry and other people are busy, they can't help you right now. They need 10 minutes to help you. You don't understand that. Like, you don't understand that. If they say no and they're not going to help you get food, you're not going to cope with that. So this is why people at this stage cannot navigate adult life, because obviously, for one thing, if you're an adult, you can take care of your own hunger most of the time. And if someone couldn't help you with that, you would just be like, well, okay. And then you'd go and do it yourself. See, there's just not like the machinery, the mental machinery. There's not the capacity required to be able to look after yourself here. So, as I said, there's first person perspective. They can look in one direction. In other words, they can identify their own needs, their own desires to some degree, but only in one direction. So there is no real, there is no real second person perspective yet. So this is progress, you know, there's enough of a sense of self, but still very little in the grand scheme of things. They see things in simple dichotomies, good or bad, clean or dirty, nice or mean. There's a very vague sense of linear time, so they can't really plan or delay gratification or delay their impulses or plan for the future or remember the past. There's like not really a sense of time in the usual sense. There's a constant sense of threat because basically their whole thing is about getting their needs met, and they don't have much input into how that happens. And so, you know, it's like the world is either with them or it's against them. The world is impinging on their needs constantly. Meaning making, again, very limited because not much of a sense of self, not much like conceptual thinking going on. So like you cannot form a complex view of the world and a complex meaning system yet. Meaning, if it has any meaning here, meaning is basically how well are my needs being met right now? And that is what life is about. It's really as simple as that. Okay, so we're going to move on to stage 2/3, which is called self-protective opportunistic. Before I do that, just want to quickly mention my sponsor, Spirit Quest Tours, which takes small groups on exclusive sacred journeys to Egypt, Peru, and Turkey. Get $500 off your next trip by using the discount code ROSS on the booking page linked below. All right, let's move on to stage 2/3, which is called self-protective opportunistic. I'm not going to call it self-protective opportunistic. I'll explain why it has both those labels, but I think I'll just call it 2/3 to keep it simple. So this is actually a really sort of big move. I mean, all stage transitions are a big move, but this one is, you know, it's something we can highlight. This is the first stage of differentiation. So it's, as I said, it's a slash stage, which means it's a stage of differentiation, whereas whole numbered stages are stages of integration. Now, what it means in this context is that the individual moves away from complete dependence on their caregiver. So it's kind of like a move apart or a move away from what they had before, which was just complete dependence. This is when the child can start to satisfy their own needs. They can sort of move around more. They understand better how the world works and so on and so forth. It's still quite basic, but it's a first move away. This is a first stage in the model where we can really be functional adults. So there's a significant chunk of the adult population here, particularly in poorer, more dangerous countries, but certainly it's not limited to such countries. There's plenty of people operating from stage 2/3 in developed countries. I think the figure that Susan Cook-Reuter gives is around 10%. Are at 2/3. This is the advanced first-person perspective, or we could call it first-second-person perspective or first-person perspective with a beginning second-person perspective. So basically what I'm saying is that it's not purely first-person, but it's also not really a true second-person perspective because, well, we'll get to that. There's a sense, there's a stronger and more coherent sense of self, particularly emotionally. You're more in touch with the self is, there's more emotions, there's stronger emotions, and your emotions are now differentiated enough that you realize that your emotions are not another person's emotions, and your needs are not another person's needs, and your wants don't necessarily coincide with other people's wants, okay? So this is when we, for the first time in our entire lives, we sense that other people actually have their own needs and wants, which is quite fascinating. That did not exist until 2/3. It simply does not exist at the earlier levels. You cannot look at other people and realize they have their own needs and wants. And you really barely look at other people as their own person anyway. However, as yet, there is no real empathy with others. There's no real ability to coordinate with them or to cooperate with them. And really, you see other people as threats, as competitors, because you see yourself as having your own needs and wants, and you, for the first time, realise that other people have them. So it can be very threatening. There's still quite a limited sense of time. And there's a limited sense of how your actions have consequences here. Magical thinking remains. In other words, like conceptual thinking, logical thinking is still pretty much non-existent. And there's little perception of standard cause and effect. Like, you don't really understand how your behaviour has consequences. You view the world as a kind of jungle. It's like me and my needs versus others and their needs. So it's like a battle of wills or a zero-sum game. This is common in children around the age of 2 before they go to nursery or kindergarten. This is when you'll see them having tantrums. You'll see them starting to become deceitful. They'll have still have very little emotional regulation. They'll have stronger emotions like anger, but they still don't have the ability to regulate the anger. And you cannot really reason with them. Like, in vain, because they understand everything in terms of their own needs, and they just see you as someone who's getting in the way of their own needs. So adults at this stage know how to get what they want to some degree, and they simply see other people as the obstacle to what they want, okay? So their own wants and desires are primary to all others, so they can resort to manipulation, control, and self-protection in order to get their needs met. And from their perspective, it's totally normal. Like, at later stages of ego development, we internalize the fact that, you know, you can't just manipulate and control people as you want, because other people have their own needs, and they might feel upset, and they might lash back at you if you do that, and there's rules against that and so on. See, this stage doesn't really understand that. And from its own perspective, because literally the entire world is just filtered through their own views, well, it just seems normal. It's like, cool, this is what I can do. I can manipulate people, control people, etc., etc. And I'm sure you know adults that basically this is their life. And I'm sure you yourself manipulate and control people as well. So we're starting to get to like aspects of human life that we can understand. I'm not saying you're always at stage two, three, but you can understand it enough, and you'll regress to it enough that you'll see when you yourself are operating from here. There are two versions of this stage. One is called the opportunistic and the other is called the self-protective. Now, both essentially see the world in the same way, and they basically make meaning the same way. In other words, they see the world as a jungle, and the meaning of life is basically to get my needs met. However, the opportunistic person tends to be on like the winning side of that equation. So in the jungle of life, they tend to be winning in terms like they maybe have physical strength so they can overpower people. Maybe they have manipulation skills. Maybe they can they have like alliances with other people that they can call on. So they're sort of on the winning side. So they're like active. They are actively getting their needs met. They're actively controlling people, manipulating people. Self-protective, on the other hand, is basically they see, you know, the worldview in the self sense is the same. And it's still a first-person perspective. It's just that they're on the losing side of the win-lose, you know, dichotomy. So they're losing. Maybe they don't have the power they need. Maybe they don't have alliances with our people. Maybe they are simply overpowered most of the time. So they still see everything egocentrically. It's just that they cannot get their needs met themselves. So they become self-protective and they become meek and passive, which is quite fascinating, because when I think of this level, I think of it as being active and being, you know, angry, and it's self-expressive and it's like domineering, but that simply isn't always the case. Like, the self-protective person tends to hide in their shell because they realize they can't, they're not actually powerful enough. One's identity is simply composed of their will, their ideas, and their wishes. And it's essentially, for that reason, it's essentially a fragile identity, because think about it. If your will is thwarted and your entire sense of self is built around your will and your desires, well, your self is deeply threatened then, isn't it? So it's very fragile. Like, you'll see in opportunistic people, I just said opportunistic, I mean 2/3, but I suppose this maybe applies more to the optimistic version, opportunistic version. With 2/3, what you'll realize is, like, they're very domineering. They are angry. They're kind of like in your face. They don't give a fuck. Pardon my French. But they're also very fragile. Like, if you show them a chink in their armor, if they do something that's embarrassing or that shows weakness, if they are overcome in some way, if they show that they aren't, like, if you win over them in some way, if you show yourself to be stronger in a certain area than them, they're going to get angry, and they're really not going to like it. And it's very fragile. It can be something stupid, and they get all angry, and they get all aggressive, and they get all self-righteous, and they get all, you know, they can even get, like, downright aggressive and violent with you. Okay, so this is simply because the person's identity is built on their needs getting met, and it's like a self-image thing. And if they show themselves unable to get their needs met or their desires, and other people are seen to be stronger than them, it's a deep threat to them. It's not just like a funny thing. It's like a threat. It's like an actual threat to their identity. They have a social front, and the social front is basically that they manipulate, they control, they lie, and they deflect, and they blame other people. And they also spend a lot of time gathering info on other people to outfight them. Okay, so it's like their social personality is quite obvious and it's quite predictable. However, on the inside, you know, when they're at home or when they're on their own, they might actually feel the opposite of these things. They might feel weak, they might doubt their strength, they might doubt their power, they might realize that other people are stronger than them, and so on and so forth. So it's like this sort of split personality. Self-respect is based on the level of control they have over others, which is ties in with what I said there. There's a preoccupation with concrete possessions and obvious symbols of power. Like, it can sort of look a bit cartoony, you know, things like having a big monster truck, for example. This is a very kind of opportunistic desire, take a stage 2/3 desire, because it's like, here's my strength, here's my power. And it's also kind of like, you know, when young boys are into, like, superheroes and action men, for example. And it's, you know, it's kind of a similar thing. It's kind of like they are... It's like the poster boys of the stage 2/3. Rules are acknowledged and they're followed if it brings immediate advantage or gain. But otherwise, the rules do not matter to them, and they actually get kind of a kick out of not following the rules, because they're setting their will over the will of other people. They look for danger and they try to avoid it. So again, the world is like a jungle, so they're always sort of on the lookout for danger, and they're preoccupied with preventing it. Their stock response when threatened is anger. So if you hit me, I will hit you back. I'll swear at you. I'll kill you. Even if you don't hit them, like if you hurt them in some way, or if you just demonstrate yourself to be superior in some way that is actually not very threatening, for most people, for them it's really threatening and they get angry. It's almost like you can sense I find with stage 2-3 people, you can sense like an underlying rage that is going on all the time. It's like, it's not always fully expressed via behavior. It's something you can sort of sense. And it's like a very dense, very kind of antisocial energy. They project their anger onto other people. So this is fascinating. Like, although there is sort of more awareness of their needs, their wants, their desires, and that their stock response to life is to get angry, essentially, this anger is still projected on other people. Which is I've talked about projection before. It's a fascinating mechanism. Basically, what we do is when things are too painful, like aspects of ourselves are too painful to admit, we project them on other people. So we see them in everyone else but ourselves. And of course, we are the ones that have it, right? So what's happening with stage 2 and 3 is that the anger is literally like their coping mechanism. And it's almost as though to become fully aware of their anger and the consequences of their anger and how it drives them would be far too painful because it would underlie their entire mind. So this anger is projected like all unacknowledged psychological material is, and therefore it's not owned. It's not, the person doesn't realize they're actually angry. It's like they see everyone else as being angry and being against them when they might actually not be. But they don't see themselves as being angry, which is kind of like a vicious cycle, because if you're raging and you don't even realize it, well, you can double the rage and you still don't realize it. Like there's like an endless amount of rage that's possible because there is no self-reflection upon it. And along these lines, the person shows little remorse, doesn't feel responsible for their actions, they blame others, and they tend to cause a lot of damage and hurt to other people without realizing it. So, to sum up, folks, those are the three pre-conventional levels of ego development: symbiotic, impulsive, and opportunistic / self-protective. I think the one that is most relevant for adults is, and for you, and for all the reasons that I spoke about at the beginning of the episode, is really stage 2/3, the opportunistic self-protective stage. Because, you know, this is really when, like at this stage, this is when we really have a fairly strong sense of self. You know, we can remember this phase in our life where we were like, you know, fighting against the world and we didn't care about the rules and it was all about anger and it was all about violence and aggression. Or maybe we were self-protective, but in any case, we were wrapped up in the first person perspective, but still sort of conscious enough to, you know, to have some measure of like decision making and of you know, having like a self-narrative, I suppose you could say. So these are the 2/3 is really when we could say like the beginning of your personality. Okay. And again, 2/3 is something we actually revert to quite easily. Like look when you're in an argument, or look when someone drives out in front of you in traffic, or look at when, you know, you and your boss are in an argument, or look at when you get sacked, or look at when someone you don't like is on TV. You actually be very surprised at how like your attention narrows and you go way back down to like the opportunistic level, and it's all just about you and your needs. and you don't really care about other people very much. And I don't say that as like a judgmental thing. It's just the structure of this level, and it's just we regress under stress. It's what we do. I just think that this stage, 2/3, is the, it's not very easy to relate to stages 1 and 2. It's quite easy to relate to stage 2 and 2/3 because we regress to it. It's like one of the early stages, earliest stages we regress to regularly. And also, I'm sure you know people who are at stage 2/3. These people are, they have a sort of dangerous aura around them. That you don't never really know where you stand because you feel like you're walking on eggshells. You feel like they could strike you at any time, like literally. You probably will have examples of them in your life. I have examples in my life, and there's a pattern. Like, it's quite an identifiable, you know, type of person. Okay, so folks, that is pre-conventional ego development. I really encourage you to go and listen to the playlist, which I'll link to. That includes last week's episode, the intro episode, and it will include the episodes 3, 4, and 5 in this series once I've published them. This series is every Wednesday in September 2026, so do come back for the next long form episodes every Wednesday. You also have snippets of each of these episodes on Thursday, Sunday, and Tuesday. This is all released always at 9 p.m. Central European Time, 8 p.m. UK Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time. Make sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. If you want to go deeper with this work, you can join my fortnightly newsletter, pre-order my latest book, The Boundless Body, or try a free coaching session with me. The links are in the description. For those, I'm Ross Edwards, 4-time author, humanistic existential coach, and host of the Deep Psychology Podcast, and I will see you next Wednesday for the next installment in this series on ego development theory. Take care.